Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So with the Media Project here, we have an opportunity for you to get some insight, if we're lucky. Otherwise, just some commentary and analysis on the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany, here with my colleagues, Ira Fussfeld, the longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Good day. Nice to see you both.
Great to see you. And here's Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at the University of Albany.
Happy to be back. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to see you and give us a chance to talk here. Where'd Alan go? Did he just step out for a moment? No. He's off one of those academic things, one of those opportunities to put on a cap and
gown. He doesn't
gown,
like to know? Say, I believe we're on a need-to-know basis.
That's right. That's right. Anyway, something when you can put on academic regalia and go somewhere, it's always great fun.
You know he'd much rather be here fighting with us.
Absolutely.
He'll just criticize us later.
That's right. We can take it. Joe in Olive Bridge, New York. I don't actually know where Olive Bridge is.
Olive Bridge is in Ulster County.
Oh, cool.
Yes, up near the reservoir.
Your area. Very good. So Joe is one of the people who's written to us this week with an interesting question raised by two different stories that he and his wife heard while they were preparing breakfast at NPR. One seemingly was featuring the European columnist for The Economist about the refugee crisis. Then his wife was more taken, and he was not, by a reporter on the scene with the refugees. She liked that story. He didn't. And he said, it occurs to me that media mavens grapple with this kind of dichotomy constantly when trying to decide on what to bring forth in their presentation each day. There are those like me who want a deep and thoughtful piece to place events into a larger context. And there are those typified by my wife at the moment who want, I don't think he means my wife at the moment. He means my typified at the moment by my wife, who want to be intensely emotionally involved as closely as can be achieved in this remove in the pathos of the moment. So while I'm sure that the public does not break down so sharply along such succinct lines, I wonder how the question plays out in the background of the decision process in the media. And I'd love to hear a thoughtful discussion of this on the Media Project.
I actually do an exercise with beginning students where I have them recall a news event that affected them personally, and I don't distinguish whether it's local or national. And invariably, you get an incident that was intensely emotional. And it breaks down by generation. And mine, it was John F. Kennedy's assassination. 9/11 comes, where people were reading the news because they had some sort of personal connection. Someone worked in the towers. Someone voted for Kennedy and felt like he was the hope. And so the factual stuff is of great interest, but you're reading it because you're close to the story. So the best news does both of those things. You don't pick, oh, I'll have a cerebral piece or I'll have an emotional piece.
Well, you might if you had enough people working on it, and one person can do the straight story and one person can do the emotional piece. But I think you're right. A really well-written piece can do both. And I think we're seeing more of it again, because in print, given the fact that the print story appears so much later than the news has occurred and people have already got the basis of what the news is, that the print story is more likely to be more of a feature approach, or what we called in the real old days a PM story, where you're not just writing the who, what, when, and where in the first paragraph, but you're couching it more creatively.
I know. I think TV and radio can also capture those stories. The migrant story is a really good example, where you're showing people who are truly suffering, and the camera brings you right there into the middle of these people.
Yeah, actually, that is one of the things that is better handled by electronic media usually than by print. Not that great writing can't bring you into something. Of course it can. But the true emotional impact of something is often better handled by television, which is why people love TV. That's why folks like to watch TV news, and it becomes their principal source because it can give you that emotional connection. But you do have to decide, you know, sometimes we have come to use as a crutch the anecdote lead. This is a technique that probably emerged in the 60s, probably alongside the rise of new journalism, but using one person to stand for the whole, and the formula became three paragraphs of anecdote lead, fourth graph is the nut graph, the hoo-ha's.
Get into the facts.
And you come back to it at the end of the story. I mean, this has become so formulaic that it sometimes, I think, detracts from the story. Sometimes you just want to say to a reporter, just tell me the facts, please.
What is the story about?
Yeah. That said, oftentimes you can't understand a story until you give it that personal dimension, and you can be lost in the facts. So you have to have, I think you're right, a little bit of both. It's not a dichotomy as much as Jack and Olive Bridge would have us believe. So anyway, we appreciate your letters. You can write to us at media@wamc.org, media@wamc.org, and we will have an opportunity to say a little bit about your thoughts and offer some commentary. So we unfortunately have to talk just a little bit today about more cuts in media industry. The digital revolution is taking its toll, this time in a couple places on the West and East Coasts. The LA Times has some big cuts coming, perhaps a $10 million cut in the budget of the LA Times newsroom. Hard to imagine that. Perhaps 80 more positions leaving the LA Times as Tribune Publishing, which owns 11 daily newspapers, tries to meet its numbers. And then in the East here, the New York Daily News has imposed another round of layoffs, including the terrific Albany columnist Bill Hammond, as well as the sports columnist who has been there for many years, Mike Lupica. Astounding, don't you think?
Well, two things. The LA Times layoff also included the firing of the publisher, who'd only been there a year. And there's something of an insurrection going on in the community out there, where there is a campaign to try to convince Tribune Company to sell the LA Times to local interests so it will be a decidedly locally controlled newspaper. And that's something a lot of newspaper markets, including my own, have experienced, where the local people, you know, blanch at the fact that the paper is owned by outside companies. But easier said than done, which is one of the reasons why the New York Daily News is having problems, because Mort Zuckerman tried to sell the Daily News and was unsuccessful. And so now he's laying people off.
He's running out of money, you think?
Well, or he's tired of losing money. And there seems to be no question that the Times, rather the News as well as the New York Post, lose money. In the New York Post's case, they're able to be floated by the success of Fox News, which, of course, Murdoch also owns. So there is another money stream coming in.
It's just hard to spin any of this as anything other than a continuing downward spiral. I am sad but very happy to be out of newspapers to sit and watch this when you're cutting your star writers, when you're having, I don't know, reporters empty their own garbage cans because you can't afford janitorial service anymore.
I carry out my own trash.
You didn't want to cut another reporter's
right.
Mm-hmm. But this is not the sign of a vibrant company, and that means you're not putting out a product that's sparkling and engaging, which it's really hard for me to see how cuts like this will bring back business.
Absolutely, and it comes at a time when you actually need more hands on deck because you're trying to do more things. You're trying to feed the digital beast all day. You're trying to do the video and audio that print never did before. In the case of the Daily News, as we sit here, there seems to be some question about whether Lupica actually was let go, because he's unique in that he's believed to be the highest paid employee and had a personal services contract, and the contract negotiations broke down. The New York Times, again, as we sit here, is suggesting that may not be a done deal, but they did wipe out a big section of the sports department, including, you know, a guy like Bill Madden, who is in the Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame. He has been there that long and is well regarded. And I'm wondering how a tabloid like the Daily News, which thrives on its sports coverage, can survive when it's just gutted that department as much as it did.
Well, you have to expect that in the case of the Daily News, at least, where sports is such an important part of newsstand sales, that they would simply bring back lower cost staffers to fill those
booths.
Well,
I think
right?
That's what will happen. But, you know, you make your name. What sells the tabloid? Mike Lupica sells tabloid. He's not only a sports columnist, he's become a general interest columnist.
Yeah, when Jimmy Breslin left the Daily News to go to New York Newsday. Mm-hmm. The thought was that he could have taken 200,000 readers with him. It didn't work out quite that well for New York Newsday. He didn't bring that many, but there's no doubt that it had a real impact on newsstand sales of the Daily News. So these columnists are all more important. It's actually something that we, even broadsheet editors, have learned that voice makes a huge difference. And there used to be a taboo in the serious newspaper world, the broadsheet world, let's say, about how you would handle columnists. And I now will frequently put one of our columnists on the front page, because if you have a writer like Chris Churchill, our local Metro columnist, or Jen Gish, our fine sports columnist, if you have some of their wonderful writing that speaks of their personality coming through, that's really attractive to readers.
And doesn't that also speak to what we just referenced regarding the kinds of stories that are written and the emotional stories? There are more columns and opinions showing up on the front page because they are something unique to what newspapers can do that you're not finding somewhere else. One thing that puzzles me, I'd love to find out more about this, is that typically when newspapers, and in most businesses, lay people off, it's the least senior people who are laid off first. And so the veteran columnists and reporters should be protected, and that's clearly not the case with the Daily News.
Yeah,
I don't know how that came
money.
About.
This is plainly a money decision, and it's just really hard to see how it is a good decision. Let's get rid of the most appealing and attractive qualities of our paper.
Well, there is good news. There is good news in the New York newspaper front, is that the Dolans are going to be out of Newsday.
Yeah.
Well, wait, not necessarily out of Newsday.
Yeah, that's part of the deal. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, this is the Dolans who own Cablevision.
Yeah.
And they're selling it to a French company, Altice. Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm.
And the Newsday is part of the package.
That's right. Look at that, my alma mater, as well as the 7 regional Channel 12 cable news networks. News 12 Long Island was the first around-the-clock local news channel in the country, developed by Cablevision in the mid-80s. Well, that's quite something. French control of a major American newspaper.
Yeah, the Dolans, for the uninitiated, are the owners, and Charles Dolan, the patriarch, is generally considered to be the father of cable TV. I mean, he was one of the first. The negativity surrounding the Dolan name in the last couple of decades has largely been because of the son, James, and that has largely become because of his stewardship of Madison Square Garden. But there aren't going to be too many people in and around that town who will miss him at Newsday, although he still will be involved with the Garden, apparently.
Well, I'm interested in the San Francisco Chronicle's effort to raise money by going directly to readers and asking for millions in a crowdfunding campaign.
Well, they're not asking for millions. They're asking for $15,000.
Oh, you're right.
Well, we should explain what that's all about.
It's a $3 million crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah, well, they want to do a story, they say, on the interplay between immigration regulations and the tech industry of the Bay Area. And so Audrey Cooper, the very smart young editor-in-chief of the Chronicle, turned to Beacon, which is a crowdfunding campaign, meaning, you know, you put it out there online and people say, I'll give you $20 for that. This isn't unusual. North Country Public Radio up in the Adirondacks, for example, has funded reporting up there through crowdfunding.
For themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But can you see a day where the Times Union would, now the Chronicle isn't part of the Hearst Company, can you see a day where you guys would be sitting around saying we want to do an investigative report in the Capital District? Dear readers, send us some money so we can do this story.
We're looking into the Nano Center. We need $15,000.
There's a plan. You know, why not? Isn't it just like doing a fundraising campaign on public radio? Isn't it just like the fund drive? Asking people to fund your particular, although this is a specific project.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
You're funding the overall initiative of public radio, but not a specific story. You know, if there ever comes a day here where Alan Shartok says, you know, we need $100,000 to keep the media project on the air.
Hey.
You know, I'm not sure where that money will go because it isn't showing up in my pocket.
Where's my bagel?
The slippery slope. Yeah, we have to investigate that. But the slippery slope is, what if someone called up and said, I will give you $15,000 to investigate X, and they make a target.
Right.
It is a slippery slope.
Yes.
But, you know, actually, NPR has lived on that for years. There was funding of, maybe it's not NPR, I'm sorry, maybe I'm thinking Marketplace. Funding of Japan coverage was provided by a Japanese, is it called the Japan House, in New York City. Health coverage is funded by Kaiser Health on NPR.
saying that we will give you money if you do health coverage.
We will give you money specifically to underwrite this type of coverage, this topic of coverage, not specifically stories, though. What you have to have is a clear wall, I would think, saying that the funders don't get to dictate what the stories are.
Right. The first time there's a negative story about Kaiser Health, where's their check going to go?
Right.
Well, there's always that danger. That's done overseas with independent investigative reporting centers where, you know, government agencies will give money for coverage of corruption. They're not telling you what to cover, how to cover, what you have to come out and say, but they want to make sure the topic gets a look.
By the way, I'm sorry, Rick. Last week we were talking about the general issue that we were discussing regarding layoffs, and I raised the question, and we said we ought to ask you because you're familiar with Europe, but are the media in Europe facing the same kind of economic crunch that we are here?
Absolutely. For the same reasons. You know, there's everyone everywhere switching to handhelds and electronic devices. They're not using print. There's not a different model. Sure, it's the same.
So their ability to do investigative reports is as hamstrung as we
Absolutely.
Are here.
Did you say government funds the reporting on corruption? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, USAID, DFID, the British equivalent of that, the Swedish and the other Scandinavian government agencies give lots of money for it's called democratic development, but it's anti-corruption.
Oh, but it's outside. It's not the government the local.
Oh, no, not the local government doesn't like that coverage at all, Rex. Yeah, the Bosnian government says, yeah, come look at
come
us.
Come on,
We're
take a look.
Yeah, no, that
would
doesn't
be quite
happen.
Something. Wow, but that we can dream, you know. But it is an interesting idea that a particular topic, well, you look at the not-for-profit newsroom, the Marshall Project, run by Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times, which is created specifically to look at criminal justice, prisons, and the like. And so somebody donating to that has an expectation, I think, of a certain kind of reporting, at least topic reporting. But again, it's not the same thing as saying a specific story.
Be very wary when you're taking that kind of money. There have been USAID grants that will go, and they want coverage of corruption, but not of corruption caused by internationals, for example, of which they're one. They want you to look at local internal corruption. So yeah, there are strings attached to a lot of this money, and the old model was nicer for reporting.
Yeah, assuming that there was no connection between advertisers and the coverage that was provided, and generally newspapers were strong enough to do that you could say, notwithstanding the fact that these supermarkets bought full-page ads in the paper every week, you would take car dealers, you would take a look at the market basket prices of groceries, or you would have aggressive coverage of the entry of new players into the supermarket wars in a community. And generally, that was the case.
Dangerous cars and bad consumer features. And there were always uproars about this when there were suspicions that it was done wrong. But it's all gotten very blurry now.
Is there an editor or a publisher who's spent more than 3 days in the newspaper business who has not been approached by an angry advertiser threatening to pull their business?
That's
a very difficult conversation, and the decision for journalists who have some integrity is an easy one. It is, no, we're not going to be swayed by your money. We're going to do it the right way. But it's a more difficult decision to be made now.
It's very difficult. I had a friend who believed that his coverage in one of the New York City newspapers cost the newspaper a multi-million dollar advertising contract. And the question was the story worth those millions of dollars? Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a very interesting question. Would you have undertaken that story if you had known that it was going to lead to how many layoffs as a result of the pulled advertising
contract?
Well,
you have to be able to live with yourself. Even if you can't quantify the pluses from running that story, you know that in your heart, if nothing else, that you compromised your principles by being swayed by an advertiser. And I've had the same instance. In our case, a smaller paper, we lost six-figure business for a while because we didn't do what one of our advertisers wanted us to do.
Well, in the past, they came back. They would go away for a while and act all huffy and mad, but they came back because virtually there was no other way to reach the mass market get out there.
Well, that's right. I mean, I used to tell people, you're not advertising with us because we're nice guys. It's not because you like us. It's because when we print your ads in our newspaper, you're going to sell your product. And that ultimately is something they will recognize.
We hope. This is the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio. He's Ira Fussfeld. Rosemeyer Mayo is here, and I'm Rex Smith, and we come to you from Albany, New York. You can send your comments to media@wamc.org, and we'll hope to get around to it, hope to talk about that kind of thing. We need to talk about the presidential race because people are always enlivened this time of year by their perceptions of how the media are covering things. A couple of issues, of course, in the aftermath of the second Republican presidential debate, there are questions about how CNN handled that. Any words of judgment from the panel here?
Well, I'll start it off. We talked about this before the show. I thought the beginning was not very propitious. I looked at it and said, oh, my God, this is like a slugfest. Everyone's talking over each other. It'll be awful. And yet I ended up watching all 3 hours, and I found overall they covered a wide range of topics. There was lots of voices. It was very, very interesting. I found myself thinking, where else in the world does this sort of political discussion go on in front of the entire country?
Well, I thought it was too long. I thought there were too many candidates, and they made the rules. They didn't necessarily have to have 11. They only had four in the JV debate, which I thought was, as was the case with the first debate, the preliminary were more substantive because there were fewer people and they were discussing things at more at length. CNN said before the debate that they wanted the candidates to engage with each other more and debate more, and I think they succeeded. On the other hand, it made it seem like a free-for-all. You know, Jake Tapper kept saying, thank you, and they would continue and they would interject. Why they needed the other two people to ask questions is beyond me. They didn't ask many.
And I sort of like that. One of them was a conservative radio show.
But they didn't.
How often do we hear that on national television?
But they didn't do much contributing. Tapper largely, I would say Tapper did 85% of the questions.
I think that was, of course, CNN is the sponsor. That's mm-hmm. their right to do that. But I think the notion was maybe you can bring in a different audience by bringing these people in.
I think they
it.
Also fed in questions that Tapper asked, too. I think there was behind-the-scenes work there. Not 11, Ira? The media gets a lot of criticism for cutting out minor candidates. We heard from a lot of people there who I'm not sure that they have a chance, but I liked hearing Carly Fiorina. I thought she was pretty amazing,
Why couldn't they have, instead of 11 and 4, why couldn't they have had 8 and 7? In other words, it was an arbitrary cutoff to say, okay, the top...
The big guys and the little guys.
And we're still very early in the game. You know, contrary to their claims that this is the Super Bowl, and CNN threw virtually everybody they had out to California. It must have been an expensive tab for that. It is only the second debate, and it is still 14 months away, or at least 4 months until the primary, the first primary. So there's going to be more time. I just thought it was, you do the public a disservice if you have all these people and you can't really judge them because they don't have a
because they only get a few seconds to offer their answer and they're talking over each other. Still, the back and forth I thought was actually helpful, where you actually got a chance to have them question each other, and you could tell when they would wind up into their stump speeches, as probably each of them did at one point or another, where they would go on and the energy level and the on the screen would just kind of fall.
And that's when Tapper began saying, thank you. I like the idea that he cut out the people who are irrelevant, like it was Trump talking to Fiorino and Rubin talking to
Rubio.
Exactly. I thought that was great. It was different.
Does it not lead CNN open to criticism that he, meaning Tapper, might have given fewer questions to Huckabee because Huckabee, he believes, is irrelevant overall and he's becoming judge and jury?
Yeah, Huckabee was complaining that it was 45 minutes before I was asked to say anything. I personally had enough of Huckabee. So maybe I'm agreeing.
Well, we have to hear him now because he's going to be in jail serving the time that the clerk
is in.
Davis, that's a lovely thought. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that in that case. It just not specifically. You know, the theatrics of the thing, of course, are very important for television. One of the interesting differences between the CNN debate and the Fox debate is just the tenor of the moderator. That is, you saw the three Fox moderators constantly smiling, laughing along at the candidates. It's sort of like a family gathering at, oh, there's Donald. You know, Uncle Donald is always so offensive. And here's Uncle Jeb. You know, he's a good guy. And they were literally smiling all the time. And when there was a parry and a counter thrust from the candidates on Fox, you would see them kind of laughing about it and smiling. That was not what you saw on CNN.
No.
It was much more of a serious presentation.
Yeah, he was stern.
It wasn't just a family affair.
And it was researched. I mean, he didn't just say, you have said. He read the exact quote and it gave the date that he said it. So you couldn't wiggle out of it. It was a different model. I can see 3 hours is long on anything, but it got a lot of information in there.
I heard something this morning that's not media related, but it's related to this issue, is that nobody has lost both both Iowa and New Hampshire and gone on to win the presidency.
All right, folks. You may be seeing the emergence of the candidates then. All right, we ran out of time suddenly. I can't imagine that. How can that happen?
We stayed on target. We only have a half hour despite our urging otherwise.
Oh, well, what can you do? Ira Fussfeld, Rosemary Mayo, and Rex Smith, thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people.